Honey, I blew up the business.
Welcome to the podcast. We have Anna Hemmings with us here today.
Hi, Dan. Good to be here. Thanks for the invite.
Well, thanks for coming. It's really great to have you here. And I'm going to, well, perhaps not mildly embarrass you, because we have very illustrious people come on this podcast, and I like to embarrass them with their list of illustrious achievements. But Anna has got a very long list of incredible achievements. But her most important is that she's the first Olympian to come on this podcast. So this tips off all your others. But she, by the way, she's a two-time Olympian, a six times world champion kayaker. She's won 11 world and European medals, nine of them gold, and is Britain's most successful ever female kayaker. And she was awarded an MBE by the Queen in 2010. So a fantastic list of gongs and things to have won, including coming on this podcast. So that's incredible. And while she retired from her sport in 2009, she's since become a widely recognized specialist in the field of resilience and psychology of high performance. So I'm really interested to dig into that today. But she's been an entrepreneur in her own right for over a decade with a training consultancy and works with big companies and innovative startups to help them deal with the ups and downs of business and life. And has been a motivational speaker for over 20 years for some of the biggest companies in the world, like Unilever and IBM and British Airways.
You know, I started my motivational speaking career when I was like 8. You know that, right?
I didn't know that, no. Really?
No, I'm just saying it makes me like 28 now.
There we go. Well, yes, you're 28. your long-term kind of speaking career. But it's great to have you here, because this whole idea about resilience, which is a theme that you talked about a lot, is something that is very much a theme in our conversations on the podcast. And I'm really interested to see how your experiences over both in sport but entrepreneurship, how that ties together and what lessons we can mine today. Before we kick off, I just want to remind you that this podcast is brought to you by my company, the tech department, the one that I blew up. It's still going. We saved it and turned it around, and it's supporting this podcast. And I want to just ask everyone for help to share the podcast with your pals, because that does help us get the message out, which we are trying to help people. And I always forget to mention, if you sign up to an email newsletter on our website, honeyibleweupthebusiness.com, we send a summary of each episode with the five top tips that we pick out of each episode. And I never mentioned that actually at the start of the podcast. So that is what we do. So sign up on the website and get all the good bits direct to your inbox. So I'm going to dive off into this conversation with Anna to dial back to 2003, nearly 20 years ago. And you had a somewhat blossoming or very successful career as a sports person. You're an Olympian and a three-time world champion at that point. And I read somewhere you said you were going to take on the world and break all these barriers. And then you said, quotes, "That was until my world quite literally fell apart." So what happened back in 2003?
Yeah, so you're right. I'd competed at my first Olympic Games in Sydney. I'd won three world titles. I have been known to say that, yes, you've probably heard me say that I was ready to keep on, you know, taking on the world, you know, keep on raising the bar, I suppose. And then I was struck by this illness called chronic fatigue syndrome. And I literally went from, you know, being on a high on cloud nine down to rock bottom in a matter of months. And this illness was something that eventually, you know, had me out of my sport for two whole years. So it was a super challenging time that I had to navigate. And the worst part about it, I guess, well, there's lots of bad things about it, but in the beginning, the worst part was that no one really knew what was wrong with me. You know, the sports doctors, their immediate assumption is that you've overtrained, because I'm complaining of, you know, my symptoms are, you know, fatigue, exhaustion, muscle tiredness, muscle ache. And it's like, well, that's what we do every day of my life. If I'm training, I feel tired and my muscles ache. That's just what happens when you push your body, you know, 4 or 5 hours a day, 6 days a week. So that's kind of normal for an athlete, but this just didn't feel normal. This was like, I couldn't recover. Like, normally you get to the end of the day, you're tired, go to sleep, you know, you eat well, sleep well, wake up in the morning, you've recovered. and you're good to go again. But this just fatigue just wouldn't go away. The muscle ache was constant to the point where it was painful. You know, I literally couldn't hold my hands up in, you know, on my head to wash my hair in the shower because it was just too painful to hold them up above my head for too long. That's not normal. And so trying to get through to the doctors that, no, this isn't just normal training fatigue. And they're like, well, you know, that's what happens when you've trained too hard for too long. You just overtrained. But I'd actually had sort of mini episodes of this for about 2 years, like 2 or 3 weeks at a time. And so I was really cautious about my training. My coach was really aware of that. And so I knew in my heart that I wasn't overtraining. I was doing less training than the other people in my group. So I knew it wasn't that, but I also didn't know what it was. And it wasn't until it had been going on for, so they do all the blood tests and nothing's coming up. Everything looks normal. Everyone thinks that I look fine. I look healthy. I look fit. You know, I've been in Florida training. I look tanned. I look muscly. You know, I look really well, but I don't feel well. And it wasn't until it'd been going, you know, I've been complaining of this for 6 months. Then they go, oh, well, now the symptoms have been prolonged for 6 months. You must have chronic fatigue syndrome. Okay. So that's useful to know that I've got a diagnosis now, but then they follow that up with, but we don't know how to treat that. And there is no treatment. There is no cure. And, you know, you probably won't get back to training and racing again because there's no treatment for this. So that's where it began.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So you, this is 2003. A period of time where things are swimming and you're going, everything's going for gold. And then the brakes start to be put on because of the illness. And you've got this, so what was going through your mind as you were sort of going into the quagmire of the illness and getting slowed down and the pain and the fatigue whilst before you got the diagnosis? I mean, how were you feeling at that time?
Mainly frustrated because I'm thinking they don't really know what's wrong. You know, I'm always like, where's the solution? What can we do? How can we get over this? There's got to be a way. And until you even know what's wrong, you can't do anything about it. And so, you know, I'm like trying to, yeah, just frustrated because like this was April, the World Championships are in September, August that year. And it's pre-Olympic year, so pre-Athens. So we have to qualify in 2003 for the Olympics in 2004. So I'm thinking, you know, it's Olympic year. I'm also thinking racing at the World Championships in my marathon distance. So in my head, mainly it's all about, you know, what's coming up and what I'm missing training right now. Need to get better, need to recover, need to get over this because like time is precious. Can't miss all this time of training. So that's my initial concern is that I need to, you know, overcome this, but quickly. And then I guess as time goes on, it's more like, okay, written off this season, got to accept that. Don't like it, but need to accept it. Now I've got a year till Athens, still need to find a solution, need to figure this out. So it was just like a ticking sort of clock that's going, right, well, okay, so I can't do this year, but I can do next year. So I was always positive that, frustrated and, you know, disappointed that season was written off. But there was always like this positivity, I suppose, that, but I'll, you know, I'll find a way and there will be a solution and I'll get back. And I guess that's one of the things that really kept me going because I had to get back. There was no choice about not getting back to training, not recovering. Just didn't register in my mind, even though people were telling me that it couldn't happen and that, you know, you're just going to have to rest and wait. And you start hearing stories of people who've suffered with CFS, ME for like 10 years, 15 years. And I'm just like, no, this can't happen. Mainly frustration.
So you've got this sort of realities biting in some respects. It's interesting. There's a whole thing about people perceiving you in a certain way and you not being like that. Like you, so you're not this, you're tanned and muscled and come back from Florida, but you're suffering on the inside and people don't quite believe you're suffering on the inside. And then the flip of it, then it inverts itself and it's like, well, no, well, you're written off now. Even though you feel like you can sustain the kind of writing off. So this whole thing about the chronic fatigue syndrome. So what I'm interested about is, so it's a thing, but they didn't have a solution for the thing. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's no conventional medicine treatment. There's lots of alternative therapies that claim to treat it. And I guess that's the path I went down after, you know, I've worked with some of the best sports doctors in the country, but they couldn't help me. And you know, the frustration. I was in Florida at one point the following winter, and I went to see this, you know, regular practice GP, and he was like, yeah, you look fine, you look well, you look healthy, you know, I've done a test, I've done an examination, you look all good, I'm sure you're fine. Like, just because I look fine on the outside doesn't mean I feel fine on the inside. And I guess that was one of the frustrating things. And then the fact that people, because everything looks fine on the outside, people then start to doubt, you know, what's wrong with you? You know, what is she just giving up? Is she, you know, making excuses? You know, yeah, all of that kind of stuff. People don't understand it. And that's also one of the most frustrating parts. There's this mysterious mystique about what it is and what causes it. And people just don't get it. And you know, I guess it's a bit like some mental illnesses where people say, you know, like depression or anything like that, where you can't see it, it's not tangible. So there's a whole mixture of things eventually going on in my head around eventually why me and why now. And I still did start to, you know, when time's moving on and things aren't progressing, I'm not getting better, it's sort of, there is some self-pity and, you know, wallowing in some misery around when it starts to dawn on me, right, Athens now isn't happening. You know, I've missed a year of training. That can't happen. It's not going to happen. And then it's like, yeah, there were moments of why me? Why now? Why is this happening? I've got so much left still to achieve, so many more ambitions. And so if there was, I have to say, despite I was quite positive, there were some moments of self-pity and sadness and, yeah.
Well, it's because you were 20, you were mid 20s at that point.
Yeah.
And so this process went on for a couple of years of wrestling with this. Now, interestingly, and again, I around about that similar time, I went through what I believe to be chronic fatigue syndrome. It was mine was as a function of working too much and not looking after myself. And I got a kind of respiratory illness, like pneumonia, and for years afterwards, couldn't get out of bed, very much the symptoms you described when you've spoken about it, very low energy, had to go to bed in the middle of the afternoon. Doctor says, I needed a holiday, which actually then manifested it. It was, I was diagnosed with depression about 8 years ago. But for me, this is all patterns of thinking and patterns of ways of getting on. And I turned to a lot of alternative therapies to help me with that. But what was interesting is this kind of, what I found was it was like, I'm confused because the doctors don't know how to fix me. And like, where do you go? And you said, where do you turn in that situation? And I was curious to see if that's how you were feeling in that time. Cause I kind of had this weird period in the noughties where I was struggling with my energy for a long time.
Yeah. So yeah, your immediate, you know, response is to look to doctors. And when conventional medicine says that they can't help you, then I just was looking elsewhere. So I went to, you know, alternative therapies, and I looked at nutrition and different types of diet, and I did acupuncture, and I did Reiki, and I did, you know, I did everything, and I tried everything, and I went to different, this place in Arizona, what was Canyon Ranch, maybe, I can't remember what it was called, like some big, you know, resort, spa, well-being, retreat type place. Can't remember what it's called, but it was brilliant. I mean, it was an amazing place. But yeah, and they had all sorts of doctors there. And it was just like finding a needle in a haystack because they were like, the bloods don't say anything. And so we're just trying to find something. And yeah, so I just talked to lots of people, tried to find you know, I was really open to all these alternative therapies and just kept trying. And it wasn't until I discovered a treatment called reverse therapy, which is an alternative therapy. And that's what helped me ultimately. I was really open. And it actually gets harder to keep trying things the more you try, because almost actually I've tried something, it didn't work. It's like, oh, have I got the energy to try again and be disappointed and keep trying and that doesn't work, and then try again and that doesn't work. And it's like, how many more can I try? But I had to keep going and had to keep trying. So I did, and eventually came across reverse therapy, and that's the one and only treatment that allowed me to recover. And so I'm very grateful to that, which was recommended to me by a friend of my sponsors at the time. So yeah, I was really grateful for that because it turned things around.
It's interesting. It's a constant experimentation.
Yeah.
Different things.
Yeah, and I think for me it was having hope. I mean, I'm a very optimistic person, and it was hope really that things will work out and that I will find a solution. And I think that's so important in all walks of life, because if we give up on hope, then what have we got? You know, we have to believe that the future is bright, and that's what stayed with me really and got me through that.
Was there a particular moment where you really felt the hope was greater than the reality? You know, the kind of maybe a period in that 2 year period where you were trying out these different treatments, they weren't working. You constantly kind of feels like you're going around in circles or moving backwards. Even was there a particular point or an example where you felt you had to really rely on that inner reserve to take you forward?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I think I was really lucky. I had great people around me as well. I had people who were also positive. I didn't allow myself to, I didn't go, there's so many forums and like, you know, places that you can read about CFS and other sufferers. And I didn't do any of that at all, because I didn't want to read about and hear about negative experiences. I didn't want to hear about these people who were suffering and had suffered for so long. And I didn't want to know about any of that. And so I just surrounded myself with people who were also positive and optimistic and believed and were on the same wavelength in terms of, let's just find a way, let's find a solution. And so, yeah, I do believe that that's what got me through it. I believe also that it was having that, I had a purpose, had a reason to get through it. It was like, you know, my dreams, my ambitions in my sporting career hadn't ended. And so I absolutely needed to, I had a reason to find a solution. Do you know what I mean? I had a purpose, why the struggle was going to be worth it. And I think that's really important in any adversity, right? You know, having a really strong goal about why I need to keep persevering, why I need, you know, and that helps you to filter out the distractions, to filter out any negativity and just remain focused on the goal, on the priority, on what's important. And I think that's a really important lesson for anyone who's facing any kind of adversity.
I saw you quoted saying that one of the most powerful ways of getting through what you were going through was opening up to the people closest to me. And I was curious about that, because I had a similar experience with my mental health travails. Is opening up has really helped me. But I was curious about how does that kind of apply in this situation? Because again, that's a counterintuitive thing to say. When you've got a health condition, the idea of opening up to others, how did that help?
So I learned to do that, and I was encouraged to do that. So it wasn't something that came from me, because I wasn't someone who did that very easily. You know, I was an athlete, and as an athlete, you put on your game face all the time. Like, I'm strong, I'm tough. You know, you never turn up to a race and show that you've been injured or you've been out for a week because you've had a cold, or, you know, you're like, I'm tough, I'm strong, I'm, you know, I'm invincible. And I sort of had that mask on all the time. You know, I wasn't very good at opening up and sharing, you know, weaknesses, showing vulnerability, anything like that. And I learned that. And I learned that through my experience with reverse therapy, because reverse therapy is about, the principle is that the mind and the body are connected, which we all know. And that the symptoms are like alarm bells. It's the alarm bells that are like your body's way of telling you that there are certain things that you're doing that your body doesn't like. You know, and it's going to give you, it's going to whisper at first, and the alarm bells are going to be quite quiet, and you need to listen out for them. But basically, I didn't listen. I didn't hear them. I didn't want, or maybe I heard them, but I didn't want to pay attention to them. And eventually they get so loud that it's like, right, now I'm just going to stop you from doing what you really want to do until you, and then hopefully then you'll listen, because I'm going to force you to listen. And so there are many triggers that cause these symptoms to happen, and one of the most common, we know from the research that they've done with reverse therapy, is that is non-expression of emotion. So not speaking up, essentially, not opening up, not showing how you're feeling, really feeling. And you know, I in the beginning, I didn't even cry about it to friends or my, you know, I'm really close to my sister, I have some close friends. I was just, and whenever someone asked me about it, be like, yeah, it's fine. I'm okay. I'm just putting on the brave face that I'm fine and I'm dealing with it. And actually on my own, I wasn't dealing with it at all. I wasn't happy. I wasn't, I was struggling and I was, I cried on my own, but I just didn't open up to anyone else. And so that's what I mean by opening up. And I learned to do that. And I learned, and that was, I'm going to say, the most powerful step and first step that I took was having the courage to open up, not to everyone and everyone, but to the people closest to me, share what I was experiencing with them, allow them to see my weaknesses, my vulnerabilities, and doing that and allowing them to help me began to make me stronger. It really did. And that was a big departure for me. As I said, that wasn't normal for me, but I learned to do it. And if I hadn't been totally honest about those struggles, I wouldn't have got through it. And I've learned the power of that. You know, I bring that into my business world now and talk to people about authentic leadership and the power of being vulnerable and how that builds connections. And, you know, we know that the strength of our resilience is based on the power and the strength of our connections. So, yeah, so I've learned a lot from that. But that's where that came from. And I think it's so important, you know, and we talk a lot about mental health these days and people are encouraged to speak up and it's absolutely necessary.
It's interesting that you said there about resilience being the connections around you or being a big fundamental part of that. And that's really interesting as a takeaway for people. And I 100% can see with my personal experience what you just expressed. I used to put my game face on, sweep things under the carpet, pretend it wasn't a problem. And then I'm diagnosed with depression and or exhaustion or chronic fatigue syndrome. And I think it's something so counterintuitive to high achiever types who think they have to be or look bulletproof all the time is actually by opening up, you're significantly more powerful. By the way, when I launched this podcast, my company nearly went bust, it was the worst time of my life. I flamed my personal life, my professional life, everything in 2017. And when we were about to press publish on this damn podcast series, I was really worried how people would perceive that, you know, clients, staff, friends, family. But the opposite of what I thought my worst fears was people would judge me and see me as weak and stupid and foolish. The opposite happened. People see you as strong, powerful, successful. And it's so counterintuitive. And on that particular subject of the perhaps counterintuitive lessons you learned there, what did you learn and how did that then apply to your future career?
Yeah, so I think that what happens, you know, it's not commonplace in the workplace for sure that people are vulnerable and they think that, you know, taking off that mask and showing weakness is showing vulnerability is a sign of weakness. And actually it's not, because it takes real courage. It took me a lot of courage to speak up and show that and to break down and cry and share that with people. And I think so. And I'm not saying that's what you need to do in the workplace. You need to burst into tears every day. But we're just talking about being vulnerable, showing who you are, being completely honest and transparent about who you are, and you know, warts and mistakes and all. And I think, and what I know happens is that it builds trust. And when we open up, we build connections, because then other people go, oh, okay, yeah, so I've had a similar experience to that. And then you start to build these connections with people and they're like, oh, so you're just a human being and actually I can relate to that. So I do a lot of workshops with teams, and one of the starting places is always about building trust, vulnerability-based trust. And that's what we work on, helping them to open up and share and share experiences. And that trust is so crucial. So that's what I've, if you ask me what I've taken away. Yeah. So it's about recognizing that that's so important for our resilience, to build those, you know, open up and build those connections, because we need that support network. You know, we need that as a leader. You know, when a leader can open up and be a little bit vulnerable, it gives permission for everyone else to do that. And we know that that trust is important as a foundation of a high performing team. So that informs a lot of my work now.
On that trust, no, I'm not sure I do know that actually, that trust is the basis of a high performing team. Can you just expand on that? Because that's kind of interesting.
Yeah. So, we absolutely have to have trust. You know, I'll give you an example. So we need to trust each other in the sense that as an example, if I am going to, you know, it's really important on a team that we're able to, you know, if we're discussing something, we've got an idea, we're trying to make a decision, find a way forward, we need to feel able to challenge one another, to feel able to disagree, to feel able to put forward an idea. And I need to trust the people in that room or around that table that if I put forward an idea, it's not going to be shot down immediately. I need to trust that they're not going to hold it against me if I put my hand up and say I made a mistake, or, you know, I don't understand this, or, you know, if I'm going to be vulnerable, I need to know, I need to trust that I'm not going to get a negative reaction from it, that people aren't going to judge me for it. And so that's why I need trust on a team, because if we can't, if we don't have that trust, then how can we have that really healthy debate? You know, we call it actually healthy conflict. You know, we need people on a team to have that brilliant discussion where I challenge you and I disagree and we bounce around ideas. You know, in the teams, the best teams in sport that I worked with, like there was one coach who I worked with, the team meetings, my God, they were like spiky, they were heated. You know, people are challenging race strategies, training plans, they're questioning ideas, and team meetings are really heated. But everyone trusts on that team that it's all done with positive intent, that it's all done with, we're just trying to make our boats go faster. We just want this team to improve. And so we trust that, you know, it's not personal. It's we're discussing issues that are important to the team, but you have to have trust on the team in order to do that. So I mean, I could give you loads of examples, but that's one example of why it's important to have trust on the team. And this isn't predictive trust, where trust where I can predict your behavior and I can predict that I know you really well. And I know that if I say something, you're going to behave in this way. And if I ask you to do something, I can trust you that you're going to get it done. That's not what I'm talking about in terms of real trust on a team. I'm talking about that vulnerability-based trust where I know I can be myself and I can, you know, say stuff and it's not going to be held against me, which is very different.
It's interesting. Yeah. And so you kind of, so those lessons of like trust and vulnerability and openness and being your true self and how that kind of affects performance. Again, it's a slightly kind of, it is counterintuitive. Vulnerability and performance are not necessarily seen in that way. And so one of the things I've seen you talk about is getting feedback. And this is perhaps, we talk about being open and receiving information, giving information. You said it's the food of champions. All athletes craving feedback and getting feedback. But to this point, now obviously feedback is this kind of like euphemism for you're about to get criticism, or, you know, I need to give you some feedback on the project or what have you. But this idea of getting feedback from people in your team or from the world, could you just speak on that? What is the food of champions?
Yeah, like athletes, we crave it, we feed on it. You know, it's like we know it makes us better. And it is, and that's my experience in business is that, yeah, someone says, hey, I want to give you some feedback. And they're like, oh, brilliant, can't wait for this conversation. but it doesn't have to be like that. And it shouldn't be like that. And so the first step is to create a culture where feedback is seen as helpful. It's seen as, this is something to help me try and improve performance. And the people have this idea, you know, they always talk about positive and negative feedback or criticism, and none of it should be seen as negative. It should all be seen as helpful. We call it motivational feedback, which is, you know, recognizing that someone's done something well and encouraging them to keep doing it. So, you know, I see you do that well. I tell you and I encourage you, you know, please keep doing that, because that has the impact of, you know, that really motivated the team, or it really, the way you expressed that, it really landed well with the team and they really got it, and, you know, keep doing that, or whatever it is. So that's motivational feedback, and it's really crucial for our confidence and our motivation. So you know, I encourage people to catch people doing things right more often, because it's just crucial. And I think people forget that part, and it's incredible how much of a positive impact it has. So that's the first thing, and that's really important. And it's just quick 2-minute conversations. That is, that's really easy, just to you know, notice it and do it. The other part of it is the, what we call developmental feedback. And so it's not negative feedback, and it doesn't need to be sandwiched with positive feedback. because it's just there to help you improve, to educate, to learn, to enhance performance, to change behavior for the better. And so it should be an engagement tool. It's not a bollocking. It's not criticizing someone. It's not belittling someone in front of a team. It's there to help them improve. And so that's not negative. That's developmental. And so it's just a change in perception. And I do this a lot with teams, with organizations, changing this culture of feedback and recognizing, you know, for us in my sport, it was just crucial. Like it was just like, you just get feedback all the time. Like I could get feedback literally every minute. Like you have a GPS on the front of the boat that you're getting feedback on your speed and your, you know, your distance traveled, and you get a heart rate monitor telling you about what intensity you're working at. You get feedback from the coach with technical feedback, and then you get off the water and you might work with a nutritionist and get muscle mass measurements. And, you know, it's just constant feedback. And it wasn't like we're waiting till the end of the season, because you can't afford to wait till the end of the season. The World Championship's been and gone. I need to know 6 months in advance that training's working or isn't working, or that my technique, yeah, this is, you know, that's working, and you're working on the aspects that we've talked about and that's landing. And so you need this constant feedback. It's like, you know, I was working with a team on Monday and they're working, they have project teams, and well, you can't wait till the end of the project to get feedback. You want to know early on that you're on track and that client's happy. It's too late at the end. You're going to be talking about all the things that went wrong. Let's identify those up early on. So it's this idea of giving and receiving constant feedback and recognizing that, particularly if you're a leader, it's not just your job, it's your obligation to give feedback, because ultimately the team won't improve. It's the bottom line, is they will not improve if you don't give them feedback. And that's why, you know, athletes are all about improvement, constant improvement. And that's why we crave it, because how else are we going to improve if someone tells us we're doing it wrong or right? So I'm really passionate about feedback, as you can
know. No, it's great. I mean, and it's funny, because in my business, we try and adopt a principle called radical candor, which is a book by a lady called Kim Scott.
Yeah, familiar with that.
Yeah, and it's for those that don't know, it's where you care deeply but challenge directly is the sort of nexus where this fits. So radical candor is not giving people a bollocking. It's like, look, you're smart, but the way you're speaking comes across as dumb. You know, yeah. let's fix that. And you're saying too much or what have you. So that's something we try and adopt and live out every day. And it's something it's hard to do, actually, because sometimes you feel a bit squirrely saying something to people because you don't want to hurt their feelings. But she talks, Kim Scott, in her book about, well, if you don't give people that feedback, how can they improve?
Exactly.
And you can't expect them to improve because you're bitching about them down the pub.
Well, I think the most important thing, and I've heard Kim Scott speak, is that people, the main reason people don't give feedback, well, one of the main reasons is that they don't know how to deliver it, and therefore they're afraid that it's going to land badly, that the reaction that they're going to get is going to provoke argument, that people are going to be defensive, that they're going to hurt their feelings. And so, you know, I do a lot of work in my training around helping people. There's models of ways of giving feedback. There are ways of giving feedback that don't offend and upset and hurt. And without that, important messages don't get through and people don't improve. And Kim Scott's absolutely right. You know, it's about showing, not just thinking about the information that you're giving, but how you say it and showing that you care and being, and showing that, and so be kind with it. And clear is kind, and unclear is unkind, and half truths are unkind, and bullshit is unkind. So it's about, you know, show that I care. And then if you have that positive intent, then it will land well. And if you learn how to deliver it in the right way.
That's great. Unclear is unkind. Is it? I'm going to put it in my t-shirt, I think, for future. I love that. Unclear is unkind.
Well, it is, because sometimes people, they're so afraid of hurting other people's feelings that they sugarcoat it, or they kind of give a half truth. And that's not really kind. Like, and that's not giving a clear explanation of what is it that I didn't do well, or what did you observe that wasn't right, or, and just be honest, tell me directly what it is. Because if you only half tell it to me, then I don't get the message properly, or it doesn't land well, or, you know, yeah. And so clear is kind, unclear is unkind.
Yeah, brilliant. There's definitely, we've got a poster postcards, t-shirts, or things we can merchandise at some point.
Remember where you heard it first.
Well, exactly. Well, I've got this, I do this often. People come out with really great one-liners, and it's like, wow, I need to do something with that. I haven't quite got around to that yet, but maybe one day. Did you actually? Because you were a kayaker at the highest level, but you weren't just any old kayaker. You were. It was more of a long distance thing. Is that correct?
Yeah, so most people think of kayaking and they think of the slalom, down the rapids and the weirs, through the gates, doing Eskimo rolls, getting battered by the white water, that kind of thing. Well, I didn't do that. So I was all about flat water, rivers, lakes, as fast as possible from one end to the other. And so the Olympic distance is 500 meters and it literally is straight line, fast as possible from one end to the other. And I competed at Sydney and Beijing Olympics in that distance. However, that wasn't my strength, really. My strength was in marathon kayak racing, which is a 35 kilometer race and, you know, around 2.5 hours. And yeah. So again, one end to the other as fast as possible, but just over a longer distance.
So one of the things I'm curious to ask you is this, that's a big undertaking and it takes a lot of endurance event. So what do you learn from that, that you've taken into your more entrepreneurial journey? And are there any parallels that you see?
What do you mean in terms of what did I learn from achieving at the highest level at that sport or from actually doing the actual distance of a marathon? Yeah,
the endurance itself.
Okay.
I'll tell you why, because I've been doing a lot of long distance running and I'm off to do the Marathon de Sable at the end of the month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and so I think this will come out after I've come back from that, hopefully, if I come back. So I've been doing some very high long distances and what I'm finding is when you're kind of very, very far into a very long running thing for me, I see some sort of parallels in the entrepreneurship thing, like managing yourself, managing your emotions, managing the distance, managing the ups and downs of that. And I'm just curious to see when you're in the middle of a marathon kayaking race and it's hard, I imagine, and you're 2/3 of the way through and perhaps it's not going the way you thought it was going to go and you've got somebody breathing down your neck or however you describe it in a kayak. What do you learn from that experience, whether that at whatever level, but like the highest level you operated at, how's that transferred into your business career, your entrepreneurial career?
It's interesting. I was doing a speech earlier last year, and someone, I think the guy, it was a corporate audience, and the guy was an Ironman or a triathlete. And he said, you know, what happens at the end of the marathon, you know, when you're blowing up and, you know, and it's, you're starting to, you've hit the wall, and how do you deal with that? And actually, I never hit the wall. I never blew up in the middle of, you know, in a marathon race on the highest level, because I prepared. And, you know, you do all the training so that you don't blow up. And you eat the right fuel in the days leading up to the race so that you don't blow up. And, you know, and it's all about the preparation. And that's relevant to any walk of life and particularly to business because, you know, I've got a really massive client meeting or big, you know, a deadline or whatever it is, you know, big presentation to do. It's all about the preparation. You know, or, you know, we've got a big launch of a product. It's all about the preparation so that we can arrive at the product launch and we know exactly what each of us in the team is doing. We know exactly what the outcome is. We know we've thought about contingency options. You know, when I'm preparing for a race, I'm thinking about my strategy for the race. I'm thinking about what my competitors might do. I don't know what they're going to do, but I'm playing out different scenarios. So I'm thinking about, you know, different race situations, and I'm preparing for every one so that in the moment I can make a decision in the heat of the moment under pressure. And I'm not flustered by it because I've seen it play out in my mind. I've seen it play out in training. You know, I visualize every race that I do so that I'm confident when I get there, so that it just all unravels automatically. You know, and so many of these things you can do in the business world, part of that preparation.
I love that. And just particularly on visualization, because again, this is something that I see you talk about. But why is that so important?
So, your mind doesn't know the difference between a vividly imagined experience and a real life experience. And so when you can see what you're doing, when you're visualizing, is you're seeing in your mind's eye the outcome that you want to achieve. It's almost like creating a blueprint for what it is you want to happen. And so when you start to see it vividly, your subconscious starts to, you unlock your subconscious and it starts to generate creative ways of achieving it. We know this is science, right? This is research has been done, and we know that the creative subconscious is unlocked. It starts to program your mind. And what it does is it starts to, your mind starts to draw in the resources, the people, the attitudes, you know, the things that you need to make it happen. And ultimately, when you can see it vividly, it's so motivating to see that in your mind's eye, and you start to believe that actually this can happen. And that's really compelling and powerful to ramp up your motivation and think, actually, I'm going to make this happen. And then you draw in all these things that allow you to make it happen. I used to use visualization before every single big race I ever did. And so for those reasons, you know, seeing a goal and seeing something happening in the future, it's really important. And for me, prior to a race, it's what allowed me to just turn up on the start line and know that I've seen this play out and I know how this happens and I know how this works and I know that the outcome is good. And so that just gives me confidence. It helps me to relax. It also, I've seen different scenarios. And so I've seen, like, you know, maybe the start didn't go so well, but I don't panic because I know how to come back from that. And I know that I can win from behind, or, you know, all these different scenarios that happen, they never throw me because I've prepared for it in my mind's eye and I've seen it all happen. And then I can just go on autopilot and it just unfolds as I wish it to. So that's why it's important. Super important.
There we go. I love it. I love it. I'm going to be adopting that because I'm working through a lot of that's such a transferable skill, that what you've just described.
Absolutely.
Running a business, which is what I do, it's just like there's myriad things that could happen. And especially having a vision in your mind of where you want to get to allows you to then sort of judge whether something's going towards or away from that. And I think that's just a very practical, useful tool. And I'm all for unlocking the creative subconscious. Enlisting that in your support, I think, is a really great takeaway for everybody coming out of this.
It is absolutely something that everyone can do. Everyone can, you know, close their eyes for a minute and just visualize themselves at a point in the future and imagine what has been accomplished. We can all do that and just give it a go and see how powerful that is and how inspiring it is. Your motivation will ramp up to make it happen.
And how do people best do that? Do you want to sit on your own, or do you just have a cup of tea and take a moment for yourself and just start to visualize that?
I think if you're not practiced at visualization, then I would encourage people to do that on their own in a quiet place. I would definitely close your eyes. I would certainly take 30 seconds to take some deep breaths and just relax, because if you're just busy and stressed and your mind's racing, you're not going to be able to see it. So you've got to calm your mind a little bit and just clear the head. And then, because then you'll see it more easily and more vividly. And as I said at the beginning, the more vividly you see it, the more your brain starts, it drives into the subconscious and it doesn't know the difference between that and reality. So those would be my steps. Quiet place, close your eyes, deep breaths, clear the head, and just visualize for a few minutes. Doesn't need to be half an hour. It can, you know, I do it regularly. It might be for 2 minutes one day, it might be for 5 minutes the next day, it might be for 30 seconds. But I'm very practiced at it. So
there we go. Well, there's a vivid visualization of what we should all be practicing every day. Well, listen, it's so rich, full of advice and takeaways there for me, and hopefully for you, dear listener. So if we want to learn more about you, Anna, where should we go to find out more?
So I have a website, annahemmings.com. That's my personal website. My training consultancy is Beyond the Barriers. So we're beyondthebarriers.co.uk. I'm on LinkedIn. I post on LinkedIn pretty much every day, giving tips and insights around high performance, leadership, resilience, high performing teams, all of that great content. I'm on Twitter a bit, but that's mainly where you're going to find me.
Well, I think we should, everybody listening, should straight away go and check her out online, because it's all good stuff, this. And I think there's so much, really, like I say, so much to learn from. And thank you for being so open about almost how you got to learn those lessons through sort of overcoming your own challenges and adversity back in 2003 with the chronic fatigue syndrome. So it's very inspiring and very kind of you to be so open. So thank you on behalf of everybody here, and go and check her out, everybody. And hold on the line, and I'll speak to you in a second, and see you next time, everybody. Bye. Do you want to get the top 5 tidbits from each episode emailed to your inbox every Friday? Yes, you do. It saves you having to go through and make notes and make a note of all the books and all the ideas that are in the podcast. We go through and we choose the top 5 we like, plus put all the links into that email. So if you just go up to honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, yes, that's honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, and just enter your email address. There's a little box, just enter it in, and we will send you that information. And it saves you having to make notes and all that. That's make your life a bit easier. And of course, if you did enjoy the episode, please consider subscribing. We are trying to help people through this. So the more people that subscribe, review, rate on Apple, Google, Podcasts, Spotify, the more people will see it and the more we can help. So help us help other people, other entrepreneurs like you. And before I go, I've got to say big up to my company, the tech department, the company we blew up and put back together again. They're generously supporting me on this mission through the podcast. So if you guys want to have a look at a company that can really help you improve your technology, make it better so your business gets better too, boosting your sales and your profit and a bit more sanity in your life, a little less stress, then head up to thetechdept.com, the tech department. My company, give us a look. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.